This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 5th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 274 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on the show, pop queen Kylie Minogue takes a break from her European tour to reflect on how it's going thus far.
Art critic Mel Gooding drops by to tell us how his new publication, Art Rules and How to Break Them, helps to demystify modern art.
And then we'll speak to Sinead Kerwin, producer of a new documentary on the miners' fight against Thatcher in the 1980s called Still the Enemy Within. She joins us alongside one of the miners, the wonderfully named Norman Strike.
All that, plus some great new music too. That's all coming up on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Welcome back to Studio One, Andrew Tuck, from your trip to Istanbul. How was that?
Very nice. We opened an office this week in Istanbul in a place called the Vault Hotel. It's going like going back to the old days of correspondence. We've taken over a hotel suite.
It's a bit Graham Greene.
Yes, which has now been transformed into the Monocle Bureau, right in the heart of Istanbul. And it'd be amazing. You come out the office, turn the corner, and there is the kind of the Bosphorus. So there's everything unfolding in front of you that happens in Istanbul.
The Bosphorus Bureau, I like it.
Yes.
It's got a ring to it.
And so Sophie Grove's normally there. She's just had a baby, though, so she's on leave at the moment. And Joseph Dana has taken over her role, and he's sitting in that office.
When we talk about bureau, is there a bureau in the bureau? Is there a roll-top desk? Is there a handsome piece of maybe mahogany furniture for Joseph to sit behind to man the decks?
There's oddly, because we've inherited some of the furniture from the hotel, there's oddly a slightly peculiar desk. It's a desk, but it's got like a glass panel so you can see into the drawer.
Okay.
Because I think normally it would have like peanuts and Pringles in it.
Oh, so it's like an office. It's like a hotel desk.
Yes, but it's got a stationery in it instead. But we did a party for the launch of the office and for the book again. We did a book signing there. And what's very nice is that there's a tradition when you open something that people send you flowers in Turkey.
Yeah.
But they send you flowers the size of a human being that look like wreaths. You think someone's died, but it's not. It's good luck.
They look like they should actually they almost spell out like dad. And you put it on the back of us. You know what I mean? It's a bit like that.
Well, they were certainly taller than both me and Steve. Yes, they were epic in proportions. But it was a really nice night. And it's funny because we've done quite a few things now in Istanbul. So it's the same thing we have in other cities. People turn up who you know now. We know all the people from Autobahn Architecture, for example. They all came along. Lots of people we know now from the Hurriyet, from all the newspapers. The columnists all came. It was great.
And Tom Reynolds went on his maiden trip. I think we've taken the mickey out of Tom Reynolds before in his luggage situation, his bright pink suitcase. Did that make it to Istanbul? And did he bring his own food? I have a feeling that Tom's the kind of man that might bring his own sandwiches to a foreign country.
He did oddly well.
He's come back with a funny tummy there, hasn't he?
He was very upset about the pink suitcase, and apparently that's been put in a skip.
I felt really sorry for him for that.
Instead, he was asked to kind of bring quite a lot of things for the bureau. So he had he looked like Madonna on tour when he arrived, but without the hair, as we know.
Right, yeah. Without the arms as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So he had a very good time.
Good. A good time was had by all.
Yes, we may take him else. Because also, just before the book signing, I lost my glasses, which isn't very helpful. The book signing was in the darkest place that you've ever seen in your life. The lights were very, very dim. And people's Turkish names, it takes a little bit of getting used to when they say them. And you have to. So Tom was very good. He was helping me by writing in giant letters on pieces of paper everyone's name.
Phonetically, how to spell things.
Well, there's quite a few things. It's like people say, okay, my name is Asil. So it's A-S-I, but no dot on the I. Did you know there's a no-dotted I in Turkish?
I didn't know that.
There is. And then there's a few other complicated ones.
It's a minefield. It's a minefield out there. Coming up next, it's a change. Well, not a change to the regular lineup, but we've got Stevie B. Steve Bloomfield is coming in to do the news look ahead. Steve, you don't have a theme tune.
I know. I'm really disappointed about that.
I think hang around long enough, you might get one.
I think the last time I did this when Tom was away, I demanded a theme tune. And there was a lot of nodding around the table.
They played Grange Hill or something.
Wow, 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 wow.
Exactly.
I think we can come up with one. I'm sure we can get something creative for you.
Okay. I always just think anyone that comes on, it should just be Septoe and Sons.
Kylie's coming in later. Maybe we can ask her.
Yeah, she maybe. Yeah, because she did write you a ditty.
She did a little ditty a while ago, didn't she?
For Santiago.
For Santiago.
Now departed from this building.
Yeah, Santiago's basket.
On the menu.
Yeah.
That's delicious, that coffee.
The coffee's nice, isn't it?
It's good.
Where's your coffee from, Rob?
Break for a commercial for the Monocle Cafe.
Yeah, exactly. I don't normally have a milk in my coffee. That's a very good cappuccino
down there.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. Right, there what's going to happen in the world next week, Steve?
Okay, we've got a good mix of things. So, kicking off with today, right now, in Brazil, the polls are open. It's the presidential elections. It's actually not just the presidential elections. It's elections for Congress, for governors, for Senate, for everything. But the main headline is, will President Dilma Rousseff be re-elected? She is up against two main rivals, Marina Silva and Aciel Neves. Marina Silva is the one-time environment minister. She had wanted to run for president herself for a new party all about sustainability, didn't get enough signatures, so she became the vice presidential candidate to Eduardo Campos of the Brazilian Social Democratic Party. He then died tragically in a plane crash just a few weeks ago. She's become the candidate. And latest polls now say she will probably get into the second round against Dilma Rousseff. So it's been a far more interesting campaign, a far more hard-fought campaign than many people suspected when it began.
And is that because the economy has slowed down and things haven't gone quite Dilma's way?
Well, Dilma had been pretty popular, but then, of course, there were these protests last summer in Sao Paulo and Rio, and then which spread to just over 100 towns and cities, ostensibly over the prices of bus fares, but then spread into talking more about the fact that public services weren't improving when all this money was being spent on the World Cup and obviously in Rio, the Olympics. But there was never really anyone to sort of coalesce around. There was never any sort of big political figure within the opposition that sort of gathered all those people that were protesting. And actually, a lot of the protesters aren't backing Marina Silva this time.
So this isn't the real deal. This is round one, is it?
This is round one, okay. Yes. So you need to get 50% of the vote. If you don't, and it looks like they probably won't, neither will, there'll be a runoff between almost certainly Dilma, but possibly Marina Silva, if not Aciel Neves.
It'd be good if it really was a runoff. Right, on your marks, get set, go. Yeah. The first one round the presidential palace.
Who'd be
gets
good?
In the door.
I think Barack Obama's a good runner.
I think he probably is.
I think Putin's quite a good runner.
Yes.
I don't think François Hollande is a very good runner.
No. We'll come on to Putin now.
Okay.
In a roundabout way. Because this week, on the 10th of October, it's Nobel Prize week.
Yep.
And it will end on the 10th.
Oh, yeah, with... better take that day off.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, some people take holidays off for Yom Kippur. Others take them off for... Oh, well, it's Nobel Peace Prize week, so I have that week off.
How many prizes are there? There's peace, science,
There's loads.
Literature.
There's science, there's literature, there's...
There's a new baking one as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yes, Mary Berry is...
yeah. Who's got the prize buns?
Exactly. You just have to make sure you don't have a soggy bottom. You don't win anything for that. So the Peace Prize is good. Do you want to know some odds on who's going to be up there?
Well, I was saying their candidates in the last few years, they've probably got Assad listed, have they?
Well, they've got Pope Francis.
Oh, yeah, he's going
to
win.
Who's not Assad, but he's at 3-1. Ban Ki-moon... 10-1.
I
know. Ooh.
I'd rather have the Pope.
Edward Snowden's on there. Do you want a couple of sort of outside bets?
A load of rotters.
a couple of outside bets. Helmut Kohl. Now, that
really?
Might be quite interesting. 12-1 because
that's
it's 25 years
after the
fall of the wall, unifying Germany. So that might be quite interesting. Angelina Jolie, 50-1. Seriously. Leonardo DiCaprio for Titanic.
Speech.
and Putin is sadly on here.
No.
Putin, no, it's odds. So it's, you know, people who.
Oh, okay. I thought it was nominated.
No, this is not in any way a shortlist. There's no official shortlist.
Okay.
Putin's odds are 50-1, which which are better odds than for Bono.
Okay.
Who's 100-1.
I might give it to Helmut Kohl.
I think Helmut Kohl is not a bad outside bet.
I'm going for the Pope.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, the Pope's a bit obvious, though, isn't it?
I know, but I quite like him. I like him. It's good.
He's not a bad guy, is he?
Have we got any more? Any more for any more?
You'll like this. Okay. This is a global event, but it's happening, Rob, very near where you grew up. It's in Lewes, East Sussex. You know, we managed to
crowbar Sussex into this program every week.
Is it cheese rolling? Is it pig rolling?
You're close. It's food related. Okay. It is the 2014 World Pea Throwing Competition.
This is brilliant. We're back to the Nobel Prize here. Give peas a chance.
Oh.
Come on.
Now we understand what it's like back in Rob's neighbourhood.
not much on. I had to
move
to London.
Were you pea chucking as a child?
Exactly. You move on to larger, heavier vegetables as you turn it. Now I'm capable.
Do you want to know?
I'm capable of tossing a marrow now.
Are you? Yeah. Are you? How far can you toss your marrow?
Well, let's not get into that. It's a family show, Steve.
Do you want to know how far the world record holder can throw a pea?
Yes.
Yeah.
38.7 metres.
That's really difficult because it's really light.
It's really small, isn't it?
There's quite a lot of technique involved in that.
Yeah, I've been looking at some photos, obviously, because I've been doing some proper research. And some people try and use a little pea shooter. So
this is just throwing with your arm.
But some are just throwing with their arm.
An overarm throw.
So some do it overarm. Some have a bit of a side action.
Yeah.
But Lewis resident Mike Deacon is the current record holder, 38.70 metres. So that is happening that's happening today.
Good man.
So, I mean, there's still time for us to go down.
I think we should go down.
Chuck a pee.
I've got a bit of local knowledge. I mean, it's East Sussex. It's not the best part.
You know which way the wind blows.
I know which way to dress.
There we are.
By the way, you're sitting. I can tell you from West Sussex.
There we are. That's it. That's your news. You've had elections, you've had peace, and you've had peas.
Thank you very much for coming in and spreading peas wherever you went.
Do I get a theme tune now?
Maybe. Okay. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Let's start at the top. The top of pop, some could argue, the queen of pop.
Kylie Minogue is no stranger here at Monocle. When we first launched, she was one of the first to enter our plush studios and lend her voice to our jingles.
Well, she's just embarked on a European tour, starting here in London at the O2. She came in a little earlier in the week to talk to Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and Rob about how things are in the dazzling world of Kylie.
It's rare on Monocle 24 that we have an audience the other side of the glass, but today we're lucky to have Kylie Minogue in the studio. Welcome.
Hi.
To the programme. And also,
don't forget me over here.
Look at that.
Oh,
who have we got?
Well, only child, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And all that. Yeah. Hi, Rob.
We're learning to share. Uh-huh. I'm the only person. We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
I heard you guys had a debrief.
We had a full debrief because someone was there on the opening night in London, and then we had someone there on Tuesday, and then I was there last night.
Basically, you've been editorially covered. Everybody is saying that this is a beautiful thing, and no one's been to such a well-humoured gig in sort of yonks.
Fantastic.
And years. But it's like everyone's coming out, everyone's looking forward to something, but it's rare that you can kind of make people bounce out of the O2 more energy than when they came in.
It is, and the feedback has just been extraordinary and pretty much the same across the board, which I couldn't ask for anything more. It's fantastic. People are just enjoying it, and I'm really proud. I think we've got a great show.
I've heard, there's been all sorts of bits and bobs. This is tittle-tattle, this is office stuff.
Please tell me the office gossip.
Arena, this is not something to be shared in an interview, but I've heard the bath scene in it is pretty good. Am I allowed to?
There's a whole sort of trip down memory lane, which is fantastic. And I think also some of the gentlemen in our office also like that when most of the guys came on stage, I'm saying the dancers, even fully robed, they would sort of end up normally just in a pair of briefs or something like that. So
it's a Monocle debrief, Kylie. What do we think about that?
Well, there is that section in the show. It's an 80s medley section, and we've created my little Kylie's doll's house. It's pink, and it's pink, and then just for added colour, there's more pink.
Okay.
And we've recreated different videos, my 80s videos. So we've got my two kind of action Ken dolls. We have Photographic Studio, which is a nod to Got to Be Certain. We have the girl dolls with hoovers, which naturally light up.
Yes, light up your hoovers, right?
And ironing boards and pink irons, and that's a nod to I Should Be So Lucky. And then finally we have the bath from I Should Be So Lucky.
I like this. The creative direction by me.
But there's an important piece of breaking news which we found just before we went on air. you specify that it's all pink because we have a mutual hate for a certain color. I just found out.
Yeah, it's definitely not purple.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not purple.
There's nothing purple going on.
I do believe there's no purple in the show.
There's no purple in this office. Though we also heard that there might be a redecorating of one of the tour buses.
That's just right.
Yeah, I had to kind of knock some of the purple out. We just discovered that today.
Yeah.
It's not our favorite color.
Mm-mm. Have you ever caught any
of
your...
But there are other colors in the show.
Okay.
That section is all about pink, but we have, you know what? I wish I could see the show just to see the lighting and see the lasers at certain points. That they are stunning.
I wonder how you pitch it, or when you were thinking about this, and I was actually asking you how many months of rehearsals were, then you said we're talking a matter of weeks, which was quite extraordinary.
We had 3 weeks to rehearse.
But I thought what's outstanding is that it is incredibly personal, but it's just friendly. Now, of course, that's a large part of who you are as well. But do you have to read the room beforehand, or it just sort of comes out when you sort of get out on stage, or do you sometimes feel you have to draw it out of them?
All of the above. One of the things that just continually blows my mind about performance and doing shows is that it's like chicken and the egg. We all come with a lot of energy. The audience come with a lot of energy. You don't really know where does it start, where does it end, and I just love that it flows around. And so there are some shows where I feel like I don't have to do that much. I just have to enjoy and let's take this ride together. There are other shows where I feel like I have to
relax
the audience. We'll just relax them and just say, hey, it's okay. We're all here together. And the combination of all that energy is just, it's the drug. It's what keeps me coming back, that's for sure.
And you've got, less than 30 dates. Obviously, we have listenership all over the world, but the continent is very important to us. So this is going to, you're in Spain, you're in Switzerland, dates in Germany, etc. Do you already have a sense as well as to how you're going to read those various arenas that you know that Barcelona is going to be a sure bet versus you're not sure what it's going to be like when you get to the Baltic countries?
Yeah, there's definitely some places. Like, for example, we did Manchester on a Friday night.
Hey, what more do you need?
They're ready to go crazy, and they did. Somewhere like Madrid or Barcelona, traditionally they are a very vocal and passionate audience. So there's certainly places where you kind of feel like that's the show that you're going to have. And as I say, other places you just have to read it and go with it.
And where's the homecoming? Is the homecoming London? Is the homecoming Australia? Where's the home gig?
Well, I'm performing in Australia in March next year. So that will be my homecoming. But, you know, London's my second home. So
yeah, it's a funny one,
I felt very much at home at the
O2. Do you still think of it as your second home? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
We're just a warm-up act, aren't we?
Well, yeah, that's it. Otherwise...
And that's the thing. Back on the audience thing. It's an interesting thing. It's up to the audience to sort of make a night something that they remember as much as the performer in a certain way. There's a kind of contract, isn't there? There's like an unwritten contract between the performer and the artist.
Oh, no, I make them
artist.
Sign it on the way in.
Yeah.
Exactly. Everyone's signing that contract.
You know where everyone lives as well, don't you? And you send a man around. But that's presumably the thing. It's like there's some... I guess some audiences are good at being audiences. Strangely, people always talk about Italy as somewhere where... English obviously isn't their first language, but having your chorus sung back to you by someone also with quite a nice accent is quite nice.
And also in Japan. In Japan, it's incredible looking out where they all have such synchronicity waving the arms back and forth. When I sang I Should Be So Lucky on the Aphrodite tour in 2011, I mean, I could barely sing the song, and all of us on stage were just so elated at the vision in front of us of this completely unified audience waving their hands. It was beautiful.
It's true audience choreography when you're over there as well. It's like, it is amazing to watch it played back to you.
Oh, we had that at the O2, actually all the shows so far when we perform Kids, which is very much a number with the band. And I say to the audience, you're in the band now, so let's all do this together. And it's incredible.
And it's one of those things with putting the show together, getting that rhythm of the show. These big shows you're playing at the O2 here in London, it's a long night and you're doing a few of them on the trot. Mm-hmm. Presumably sometimes you just want to go, right, let's go for it, and run for 3 hours around that stage.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to sort of pace yourself and you've got to know when to bring the audience
in. I do.
Presumably is that something that gets given to you or is that something learnt?
It is something learnt for sure, and it's something that's really... really difficult to do. There's times where my energy might be low from traveling or whatever, and I will say to myself before the show, okay, just go on cruise control tonight. cruise control is still great.
Yeah.
Just go cruise control. I never go cruise control because you know, within 2 hours,
it's a lot happens. Too exciting, presumably.
It's too darn exciting. And by the end, I've depleted way too much energy, but I get it back. I get it from the audience. And even the next day when you kind of got to drag yourself out of bed, drag yourself back to the venue and you think, how on earth will I do this again? But you do, because the adrenaline comes back and the audience is there, and I want to give everything that I have every night.
Now, and you have to give it again and again and again. As I said, Cardiff awaits. We're going to let you go. But we wanted you to just select a song from the new album. If we're going to play out with something, what do you want to go with?
Oh, you know what? I would say Kiss Me Once, which is not only the title track of the album, but it's a song that I believe really comes to life in this tour. It sounds so magnificent live, and we've put this little extended bit in there, and I go all Kate Bush on myself and dance around in the middle of that song because it genuinely moves me, and if anyone's going to come see the show, that's one of my secret favourite moments in the tour.
Check out Kylie Minogue. This is Kiss Me Once. Best experienced we hear live. So there's plenty of dates coming up. Kylie, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
And that was the unmistakable sound of Kylie.
Food on film. We traveled to Helsinki to meet the merchants serving up the very best in Nordic cuisine at Helsinki's oldest portside market.
Service and quality are at the very heart of the market's reinvention and its continued importance over the past 120 years. Many of the stallholders have held pitches in these pinewood stalls for generations and forged close relationships with their long-held customers.
Market value. Now playing in the film section of Monocle.com.
Many will be able to identify with that situation when you're looking at a masterpiece, or more likely, a piece of modern art, and you just don't quite get it. And there's only so much nodding and agreeing that you can get away with before your opinion is asked and your cover is blown.
Well, our next guest is hoping to make modern art more accessible by challenging theoretical pigeonholing and encouraging the creative engagement it has with its audience.
Art Rules and How to Break Them is a set of cards with an accompanying book by art critic Mel Gooding. There are 7 sets of 6 cards covering categories such as collage, found art and photo art. Each card breaks down how you would create the image on the other side and provides some historical even context too.
And Mel joins us in the studio now. Mel, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. And talk us through the cards. How did you get the idea of doing this card thing rather than putting together a picture book, as it were, to lead people through the complicated world of modern art?
Well, first of all, there are no end of picture books that purport to introduce, explain, make a kind of understandable modern art, as if it were a kind of problem in people's lives that has to be addressed in this way. And also as if, of course, people need to be schooled to approach every work of art, every work of modern art, we'll say at this particular moment, it's true of all art, of course, but to approach every work of art as if it's an example of something else. And that leads to a lot of problems, you see. It's a kind of circular thing happens. You approach, let's take a classically difficult, I put that word in, mm-hmm. in kind of inverted commas, a classically difficult work of modern art, say one of the Picasso or Braque analytic cubist works. You know, it's all brown, it's facets, it's so on. You can't make out what the subject is. You're told it's a guitarist or a portrait of the poet or something like that. And you peer and you see all these things. You think, how can it be that? And yet, according to art historians and critics, and as a consequence of a century of us looking at that work, these works now have the air and the feeling, the aura of old masters, and yet people still find them difficult 100 years or more after they were painted. But how do you stop them finding it difficult? Oh, well, you say that it's an example of analytic cubism.
And we're like, oh, that, yeah, brilliant.
So then people say, well, yes, great. What is that? And I say, well, analytic cubism is this. So this is an analytic cubist work. And I can understand it because I know what analytic cubism is. Because you're in a circular thing there. It's what it is because it's what it is. And I think a lot of people approach all sorts of works in the whole 100 of works made in the whole 100 years since 1910, 1911, when the great classic cubist works were painted, as if they are, as I said, examples of something else that they need to know about. Well, actually, they're not. They're vital, living, vibrant, in some senses, magical objects, these paintings and these objects and these collections of material and so on. They're there for you to respond to, bringing to that encounter with them all the knowledge and the feeling and the thought you may have about all sorts of other things, not art itself alone, but all sorts of other things in life and so on. And one's experience grows and one becomes less intimidated. One of the reasons I wanted to make this box book was that as an art writer, as a critic, it produces the same effect at dinner tables as if you announce that you're a psychologist.
Yeah.
You know, people suddenly think, I better not say anything, otherwise I shall, you know, my cover will be blown,
yeah,
to use your own expression. And they then say, well, what's the hot ticket? What's the thing to be seen? This, you know, they try that because they think that you have some kind of very special knowledge that when you go into an exhibition or whatever, you know by some extraordinary process, you know what they're about, these paintings about. You know how to understand them and so on, all that other stuff, all of which is a kind of nonsense. When I was writing occasional criticism, that's to say when I was writing for magazines and papers, I'd be sent to look at an exhibition or I'd go and have a look at an exhibition. When I entered an exhibition of new and strange and interesting things, I was in a greater state of funk than anybody else. I mean, after all, anybody can go into an exhibition and say, oh, don't like this, or don't like that one much, or that's a nice one,
yeah,
or I like the colour there, and so on. Whereas I knew that something was going to have to be formulated, something that had to be said about it, what was going on here.
And is part of it, people are scared to engage with it, people are scared to talk about how art makes them feel. When you walk around a gallery, when you look at some of these works, the power of them is how they make you feel, like a piece of music makes you feel. That's something that people feel, that a painting has to be about something or a work has to be about something. You put, when you just use that word, Mel, you put that in inverted commas as well, didn't you? Yes. Is that the problem, that people can't or feel that just having a reaction to a painting is not valuable enough?
It's not just feeling, you know, it's also thought. And in fact, you can't separate your thoughts from your feelings. These are not separate parts of any response. And what the eye sees is actually what the mind makes of what the eye sees. The eye is just a mechanical, you know, device for translating, if you like, what is going on in that world into something that's going on in the inside world. And once it gets there, you've got to think about it. The eye, as someone said, is part of the mind. And therefore, whenever we sight is itself locked into a very complex set of operations all the time. So it's not just feeling, it is thought. But I like to think of them as being, in a way, combined. You can't separate the one from the other. But certainly what you say is true. People feel embarrassed. They might have got the wrong take on this. One of the points of art rules is to say, look, there is no wrong take. I mean, Roland Barthes, you know, the French critic, said a very good thing. He says the critic has to make up something, but he can't just make up anything. He said, if you believe that, try it.
Yeah.
So in writing about art, what one is concerned about is making a plausible or a coherent kind of response articulate, so that people can respond to that in itself, not to be told or guided even, but to be given something that they can reflect on in relation to their own experience. of the object, of the work, of
now,
the event.
Now, we've got here, for example, the section you've done on found objects transformed. So there's a great explanation of exactly what that means. And then you go into kind of the kind of more divisions of it. So it's sculpture, it's modified, ready-made. And it's got a nice kind of explanation at the top, and then it gives you examples of the artists. So is your ambition that actually, if I use this, or whoever buys it uses it, as you say, there's a sense of liberation that you have a groundwork of knowledge, but you're freeing people up to say, actually, my personal experience or how I've found the art is just as important as anybody else's in a way. That it's, there's, a, of course, a relationship with the painting or the object or the sculpture we look at, which is to do with art history, but there is a percentage of it which is personal, which is not to be governed by, as you say, by any rules.
That's true. And if we look at a great new motor car, we're aware of the history of the motor car. I mean, if we look at a certain kind of streamlining, we're aware that what preceded it was the lack of streamlining and so on and so forth. Of course, that is part of it. It's a very important part of it, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a systematic thing. In the box, in the book, I make a distinction between art historians and art writers. And I said, you know, art history is a secondary activity. You know, art historians work on what's already in a way been sorted. And who has sorted it? What sorted the good or the interesting from the bad or the uninteresting has been a whole complex of different factors. And that includes not just critics, not just the artists themselves, but dealers, collectors, curators, and so on, and other artists who have done works that are responding to that particular work. So all of these are part of what I call the discourse. And it's the discourse that actually determines what a work might mean or might not mean. And that meaning is always, how can I put it, provisional.
I always, when we talk about art, when we write about art in the magazine and talk about it on this radio station, I always ask about the state of beauty. You talked about Braque and Picasso, these cubist works, which are not maybe easily beautiful. How much is beautiful in your box of cards with all these works of art?
Beautiful became a kind of dirty word.
Exactly,
you know,
yeah.
In art. I never did understand it because for me it's a key word. One is using it all the time. Beautiful itself has no meaning, of course. It means I find this beautiful. It means something about this appeals to me in a kind of sensuous or intellectually sensuous way. You know, I find it beautiful is an indispensable word to me. And, I think it's crucial that we actually keep that word in currency and allow it to be used because it's basically is an expression of feeling rather than a definitive kind of statement.
We're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much indeed. Art Rules and How to Break Them is out now. It's published by Redstone Press. You should look it up online because it's a beautiful sort of box of tricks and it's a wonderful idea. Mel Gooding, thank you very much for joining us.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our 4 daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The miners' strike of the mid-1980s here in the UK was one of the longest of its kind in the country. Under then-Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's command, the government declared war on Britain's unions, including the National Union of Mine Workers, and announced the closure of 20 coal mines and 70 pits. 160,000 workers responded.
The events have been well documented over the past 3 decades, or at least that's how it seemed. But some might argue that the mainstream media at the time wasn't telling the whole truth.
Well, a new documentary entitled Still the Enemy Within hopes to shed new light on the events that took place. This time, rather than getting opinion from politicians and experts, the story is told through the eyes of the workers who were under threat at the time.
They were going to attack, take on weaker unions before they come for stronger unions. This were outlined in Ridley Plan.
You know, whole groups of workers had been attacked. You'd attack the health workers, the rail workers, the steel workers. And we realised that we were the next in line.
I'm now joined by one of those miners, Norman Strike, and the producer of the film, Sinead Kirwan. Welcome both to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
It's been quite a busy couple of weeks for you guys, kind of going round, touring round, talking about the film. Norman, I wanted to ask you first whether during that time, which was such, it was almost like a kind of, almost like a bit of civil war in the UK, whether you ever thought you'd be able to get far enough away from it to make a film like this, to be in a film like this, and to have a maybe a measured response, or certainly a response that's 30 years old now.
I never thought anybody would be interested, to be honest. So when the people who were doing the film contacted me and asked me if I'd like to take part, I was thrilled because it's a story that needs to be told. And like you said, it's been told by the media, but it's never been told by us, the people who actually took part in it. And it's as vivid to me today as it was 30 years ago.
Sinead, the film is, as we said, told through the eyes of the workers, the people who are involved in the strikes. And it charts from their viewpoint the triumphs and then the failures and then the slow return to work and what happened to the industry. Again, why did you think it was important to have a story which is one-sided in the best possible sense? It's from a certain viewpoint. Why did you feel it was necessary at this time to make that film?
Well, first of all, we think when we came across it, we just thought it was such an epic story, and we were almost amazed that this huge part of British history had never been made into a long-form documentary. And also we'd felt that a lot of the programmes that had been made were so eager to be neutral that you'd hear from a politician, a policeman, and maybe 3 or 4 minutes of an hour-long programme would be with a miner. And we don't really think that fully reflected people's everyday experience. And we also thought it would be a false bias if we sort of pretended that we were going to present an even-sided view. And we thought it was much more true to just let the miners tell their story, and then people can seek out other sources of information afterwards to find the other side. But it would be a bit fake for us to pretend that we were presenting a neutral view when we weren't doing that, and that wasn't our plan.
And that's presumably the beauty of making this film. You crowdfunded this film, and you know it exists as something that you all own and you have a part in, rather than making it for state TV, for example, making it for the BBC, for example, is a different thing. You're much freer, presumably, and you can tell the story that you wanted to tell, or see how that story turns out, because presumably it might be a different one that you started telling to the one that you've ended up telling.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when we started making this project, it was mainly because the 30-year anniversary was approaching, and we thought, you know, we'll go and interview some of these guys. They're really, really interesting. We'll make a bit of an archive project. But the stories and the way they told the stories were so amazing and so emotional and really so engaging. We were like, this is a film. Even if it was not connected to the 30th anniversary, the story of people standing up against this huge force, you know, coming together, the story of new bonds and unity is such a universal story that actually we were like, we have to make this film. This is a story that has to be told.
Norman, one of the things that becomes clear from watching the film is, you know, this idea of, you know, you're fighting for much more than just the pits. You were fighting for communities, and communities in lots of senses. At the beginning of the film, you hear the workers talking about how they'd talk about the football match while they were underground. There was the community of the men, but there was the community above the mines as well that were being attacked by all these government policies. But as you watch the film, there's this terrible moment as communities begin to pull apart a bit as well. As some workers went back to work in Nottingham, the strike took a different tack. When you were involved in that battle, were those very hard times when you saw divisions within your own communities coming to the fore?
I was angry, and I still am angry to this day at the miners in Nottingham. And of course, they've all lost their jobs now, just like we taught them they would if they didn't stand up and fight with us. So it was a really hard and bitter time. And of course, at my pit, I worked at a colliery called West Oak Colliery in the Durham coalfield. There was 2,500 men, and they didn't start to go back, and even until October, November time, and it was ones and twos. Even by the end of the strike, there was no more than about 50 men out of 2,500 went back. So the divisions in my colliery, and that's all I can speak about, weren't as great as they were in lots of other places where they flooded back to work. But yeah, it was a hard year. But I'm still proud I took part in it, and I'd do it again.
Norman, the word solidarity was used so much during the miners' strike, and it's one of the sort of key words and ideas that comes out in the film as well. Was that solidarity, did that exist to the same extent before the strike, before you as a group of men and families and communities felt threatened? Or was that something that came out of it? Are your bonds closer because of the strike, I wonder?
Our bonds are definitely closer because of what we all went through in the strike. But when you talk about solidarity, we had solidarity amongst our own communities and amongst miners. What we didn't get, and the reason we lost the strike, was we didn't get any solidarity from the rest of the trade union movement. We just needed one group of workers to join us, and it would have snowballed and we would have won that strike. And yet every time anybody came anywhere near joining us, the rail workers, the dockers, they were bought off by the government. And our own deputies, the NACODS union, if they'd come out like they said they were going to do in the November, that strike would have been over and we would have won. And they were bought off as well. And of course, they're all on the dole now.
Sinead, when you look at what happened to the families, that's the length of the strike was extraordinary. And so families were putting up with having, you know, no income, supporting kids, you know, they went without in huge ways. Was that a part of the story you tell amazingly well? Were you struck as you met all these miners about how much hardship they'd had to kind of go through?
Absolutely. I think everyone of my generation, I was born in 1985, grows up with an idea of the miners' strike, and it was quite hard. But there was one point in an interview, I think, with Paul Simons, who's one of the main contributors of the film, where he says, take your salary for a whole year and put it in a drawer and don't touch it. And that's what it was like being on strike. And that, for me, is one of the key moments in the film that really brings it home hard when you think, well, how did people survive? You know, what did people go through with no money? No, I mean, I'm lucky I've only been unemployed for a very small amount of time. And that was very hard, even with kind of benefits. And the government totally stopped most benefits for miners. So the only thing that kept them going was, different kinds of solidarity, financial solidarity from people all across the country. They really relied on that to survive. So it was hard for them, but I think a lot of people discovered that they had a connection with so many people around the country that also was a very positive experience.
Norman, there was solidarity in other quarters, though. The film shows, you know, everything from, you know, the world of rock music to, but people were giving cash to support you and wanted you to kind of get through this difficult time. Was that a strange thing, that there was these, you know, odd corners of the world and of Britain that were kind of backing you while the trade unions weren't?
The support we got was absolutely fantastic. You know, there was support groups all over the country, colleges, universities, ordinary people. You know, we had old people coming up, you know, taking money out of their pension and putting it into the bucket. And it was fantastic. So, yes, you're right. You know, that was great solidarity that we got from ordinary people. And we couldn't have lasted the year without that support. Also, you know, trade unions in Russia, in Poland, in France, they all sent us, you know, great big lorries full of food to help us get by, you know, and we had our soup kitchens. And there was a fantastic sense of community that you don't get these days, where everybody was in the same boat. We all had nothing. And so we'd all go to the soup kitchen and eat our meals and chat and, you know, G people up who were feeling a bit down. It was a fantastic time in terms of community. And I think it's something that seems to have been lost these days.
You've got Union Jack on your T-shirt. Do you think I wanted to ask you about whether you thought the rest of the country supported the miners. It seems like it was a proper North-South story as well. And I don't know whether the country and the news narrative has recovered from the miners' strike in terms of that North-South divide.
There wasn't a North-South divide. I mean, you know, I came down to London. I was banned off every picket line in Great Britain for a period. And I came down to London to collect. And I was amazed at the, you know, these chaps with bowler hats and briefcases were putting money in the bucket.
Right.
So it wasn't a North-South divide in terms of the solidarity with us. And I mean, if you've seen the film Pride, that was London gays and lesbians who supported a colliery in Wales.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, and the Scottish miners were getting supported as well. I don't think there was a North-South divide in terms of solidarity. I think we were well supported by everybody.
When you look at the film, the other thing that strikes you is a bigger picture thing to do with Britain, and this is probably to both of you. I guess you that there was a time where this was the time of Thatcher and Arthur Scargill, you know, powerful characters representing very different views of what Britain should be and what the future was. In a way, when you now look at, you know, all of the politicians, all of the union leaders, they seem to be clustered around a very central middle ground. There is no Nigel Farage, for whatever he says, he's certainly no Thatcher. And there isn't really a figure on the union scene these days who ignites or brings together the working community in the same sense as Arthur Scargill did. You do feel that Britain has fundamentally changed from that time, in a sense that the politics of it have kind of vanished with the mines, in a way.
I despair at politics today. You know, Neil Kinnock was an awful Labour leader, you know, and he didn't support the miners at all during that strike. But they had clause 4 in the Labour Party constitution, you know, to create an equal society for everybody, which Blair quickly removed. And since that time, I think the political classes in this country are just completely disassociated from ordinary people. They haven't got a clue what's going on. And, you know, Miliband's just a Tory with a red tie. And Farage is worrying. He's very worrying. And I think people should be worried about him as well, because, you know, they're putting across about politicians, Labour and Conservative and Lib Dem, are professional politicians. But we're not. We're not professional. We're like you. And we'll go there and we'll speak for you. But they won't.
Sinead, when you got to see the final film, once it was made, what was your emotion at seeing it all together? Because it is to watch it is very emotional. It's you're tugged along through this narrative, and unfortunately you know what the ending is going to be in many senses. And it's quite a tough film to watch unfold, I think.
I mean, first of all, my feeling was, I was kind of amazed that I could still be so moved by it, because some of these interviews, I transcribed the first set of interviews, so I'd watched a lot of them sort of again and again and again. And I was really, it was really incredible to me to see it all put together. And I was also amazed, and this is down to Owen Gale, the director, and the editor, Paul, and our other producer, Amelia, that they managed to recreate that sense of kind of tension, particularly around things like NACODs. At one point in the film, sort of forget, you know, there's a moment where I think, oh no, maybe they're gonna win. And I was like, this is ridiculous. I've been doing this, I've been making this film for 2 years. I know what happens at the end. But I really think that's really the feeling that we wanted to create in the audience as well, that even if you know the end of the story, that you get taken on that roller coaster. And it's hard to watch, but it's also very funny. You know, there are light moments, quite a lot light moments in the strike, which is another reason why we decided to make this film, is that we felt like all other programmes were so sort of hued with this feeling of misery from the beginning, and it kind of massively contrasted with people saying it was the best year of their lives. So, you know, it was a very hard time, but it was also a very enjoyable time at parts, which, you know, I think is what makes the film exciting.
The film is still The Enemy Within, and it's in UK cinemas out now. We should head people, our international listeners, to the website, which is theenemywithin, with dashes between .org.uk, because I guess it's going to be a big deal on DVD as well internationally. Norman and Sinead, thank you both very much for coming in. And there we have it, Andrew. That was edition 274 of the Monocle Weekly.
A classic.
It was pretty good, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I like having former mine worker who struck in the 1980s and Kylie on the same show. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's good. That's a good radio program right there.
That's a range, isn't it?
That is a range. I like Norman Strike a lot.
It's such a good name.
Norman's pretty good, isn't it? So, do you think he might have found trouble getting employed after people realised what his name was?
But
at least for a lot.
what is amazing is that, you know, I guess we've seen that with all our guests today, is, you know, that thing of passion. You know, 30 years on, he's still as angry and as proud and as, you know, fired up by those events as if they were kind of happening, you know, outside the door now.
Yeah, I know. It's one of those things. It was when he was talking, we talked, I think, between this bit and the next about how it's like a war. It was like a war. It was like a civil war in England, wasn't it? Strangely.
Yeah, and especially when you saw, you know, they were called, you know, the Battle of Orgreave. They were seen on our TV screens, you know, as huge kind of epic battles. They were terrifying times.
And the artwork or the tapestries that they made that were amazing as well. They were kind of the things. Yeah. They were kind of like the things. They were like Bayeux-ish. They were kind of things that celebrated these battles, these strikes, these kind of everything they felt and put into these kind of amazing, almost like folk art tapestries that they waved around and hung up and displayed. It's kind of an amazing thing. And yeah, Norman Strike, what a character. I'd want him to back me in any fight. he's a really good talker. What a great talker. I mean, he's a politician.
And that's also how you can believe in. How a documentary succeeds, you need to find somebody that embodies all of the things that happened at that time and who can speak eloquently. And he was very good. And we loved Mel Gooding too. Thanks, Mel, for coming to talk about modern art. And we loved Kylie.
Love Kylie.
Just love
What's
Kylie.
What's not to like?
Yeah. I went to see her as well.
Oh, did you? Yeah. I'm the only person that hasn't seen it.
Very, very good.
We should thank Claire Urban behind the glass, smiling from behind the glass.
She
was our studio manager today, but she was also a lot more. She did all the guests, ferried everyone in and out, did all the stuff. She was brilliant. And Holly Fisher as well for producing the show. We'll be back same time, same place here in Studio 2. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.